Well, this morning we are continuing with our present series of sermons in the 11th chapter in Hebrews. And we're looking at the last verses of this chapter in Hebrews. We have been thinking in this chapter for some considerable time now, this chapter dealing with faith, but also the chapter dealing with works. And the chapter is written, of course, to encourage those Hebrew Christians who were fainting, and some of them were apparently thinking of going back into the Judaism of their pre-Christian days, the old religion. And it seems that the embracing of the gospel has brought them nothing but trouble, persecution, the spoiling of their goods, death for some of them, it seems, imprisonment for others, and they seem, on the face of it, to have exchanged something good for something very much worse. And the theme of Hebrews, generally, is that they have embraced a better thing in embracing Christ. He is better than the angels, better than Moses, better than the priesthood. He is better than everything, and God has provided a better thing for them in the gospel, even although on the face of it, it may not seem to be so. So the writer is reminding them in this great chapter that the people of God have always had to live by faith. It has never been easy to live by faith. There are no ideal times or places, much as they might wish it to be so. And faith is always something that has to struggle, as it were, for its very existence. Faith is always opposed, it is always tested, it is always triumphant through many afflictions. This is the kind of thing that we've been looking at over the past number of months. Last Sunday morning, we came to the closing verses, which really begin at verse number 32, having looked at the previous 10 examples of faith that are given, he then begins to summarize in a more general kind of a way. And we began this final section last Sunday morning, verses 32 to 40, making some general comments on these verses. And I indicated last time that we were going to come back and look in more detail at these last verses. There's details here that we simply mustn't omit. It would be real negligence on my part simply to pass over very briefly. There's too much here of interest and instruction for us. So we come, having given a general overview of these verses, we're beginning now to look at them in more detail. And we're going to think this morning particularly about verses 32 to 35. We could take verse 32. It's our most interesting verse, and it may well be that I'll come back to it. I'm thinking of coming back to it. But at this particular juncture, we're going to take it in a broader sweep. So verses 32 to 35 this morning we think about. And these verses read, "What shall I say more? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and of Barak and of Samson and of Jephthah, of David also and Samuel and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens, women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection." And then, of course, he goes on to describe further the sufferings and experiences which we'll come to, God willing, next time. But we're going to limit our attention this morning to these verses. Now, it is obvious that what the writer is doing in this chapter generally is really doing what he has been doing throughout the whole epistle. And that is, he is writing on the assumption that the people to whom he is writing know the scripture. That is why he speaks about Melchizedek. He goes into details about the temple and the priesthood and the sacrifices on the assumption that these people are well-versed in the narrative, at least the general narrative of their own Old Testament scriptures. And it is obvious from what he has been saying in this chapter that he is making the same kind of assumption. He doesn't have to introduce, as it were, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses, and Rahab. They already know who these individuals are. He's simply pointing out some salient things, not everything about these individuals. We're not told everything about them. We're just given a mention of something that they did that was worthwhile and is taken up as an example of faith. There are many other things that they did as well that he could have mentioned, but he's taking these simply as a sample on the understanding that they know perfectly well. There's a lot more here than simply meets the eye or what he is saying to them. And it's the same here in these verses. In verse number 32, for example, he mentions six names, and then he mentions a whole group, the prophets, clustering them all together. And he goes into some detail on the assumption, again, that he doesn't have to explain who these people are. He doesn't remind them who Barak is and who Samson is and Jephthah. He knows that they are acquainted with these individuals. And he doesn't even tell of their exploits individually, as he has been doing up until this particular point. He tells us specifically, for example, in the case of Rahab, that her faith was that she received the spies in peace. There was more to Rahab's faith than that. He doesn't tell us, for example, that Rahab believed in the God of Israel because she had heard what the God of Israel was doing. That was also true of Rahab's faith, but that's not mentioned. It's understood. It's taken for granted. But what she actually did was something positive and practical. She received the spies not as invading enemies or a threat. She received them as her friends and indeed as her deliverer and indeed as co-religionists. She now herself in Jericho was a worshipper of the living and the true God before the spies ever entered Jericho. She was already a converted woman. There was much lacking in her faith, but there was much also genuine in her faith, according to the scripture. And what she did was not the beginning of her faith when she received the spies in peace. It was the outcome, it was the evidence of faith that was already in the heart of that woman. And so it is with all of these individuals that he has been mentioning. And likewise here, he is simply mentioning the names all together. And then he is mentioning their exploits all together. So as we look then at these verses 32 to 35 this morning, the first and the obvious thing to do is to take a look at who they were, or to ask the question, well, who are these people that our writer is speaking about here? For the time would fail me to, he says, what more shall I say? In other words, I could go on and on and on and on. He could spend a long time writing about these great examples of faith. But as he reminds us at the end of this epistle, he is intending to write only what he calls a brief exhortation. So he's not going to go into a great deal of detail, but he is going to go into sufficiently cogent arguments to make the point that faith is the essential ingredient always in God's dealing with his people for salvation. And so he mentions here these individuals. Who are these individuals? Well, he reminds us there are many more that he could mention than the ones that he has mentioned, and by implication, many more that he could mention over and above the ones he's mentioning in verse number 32. For the simple reason, he simply lumps the prophets. He doesn't mention them by name. But immediately that you and I would think of the Old Testament worthies and those who are worthy of emulation and to whom we should pay attention, we would think immediately of the prophets. But the writer here doesn't mention the prophets by name. He simply mentions them all together. And he mentions Samuel because Samuel is the beginning of the prophets. So who are these individuals? Well, there are many of them. There are too many for him to mention in detail and in all their exploits, but he's going to give us 6 further individuals. And notice he mentions them, and they're all very different. So far in the history, our writer has been dealing with the early chapters of Genesis. He has taken us through to the book of Deuteronomy, the time of Moses and the time of the Exodus. He now enters the book of Joshua, you may remember, the walls of Jericho falling down and Rahab, the harlot. They are recorded for us in the book of Joshua. But he doesn't go into any detail about how faith conquered the land of Canaan. He doesn't go into any further details. Having mentioned Joshua and having mentioned Rahab, he then moves into the book of Judges and into the first and the second books of Samuel and so on. So what he is doing here in this verse and in these following verses is he is encompassing hundreds of years of ancient Hebrew history. Something like maybe 300 years of history are encompassed in what the writer is saying concerning these individuals. So who are they? Well, they're all different. They're all called to be a people for God in different kinds of circumstances. They all have different strengths. They all have different vices and different virtues. They all live in different times and in different sets of circumstances. And they are therefore called upon to do different kinds of things. He begins by mentioning Gideon. And you remember Gideon comes before us as that man. We're not told specifically what it is about Gideon that is specifically in mind in the writer, in the writer's mind here. But Gideon, of course, is remembered for that testing of God, if you like, by the fleece. The fleece having dew on it or not having dew on it in the morning. And then, of course, when Gideon went out, you remember how he had an army of 300 men. And they were reduced from many, many more down to 300 men. And with 300 men, you remember how he smote the Ammonites, was it, on that particular occasion. And that was a great act of faith, because Gideon was told by the Lord not to increase his army, but actually to reduce his army. Thousands were too many. It could even be argued that 300 were too many. But the Lord was going to give Gideon the victory. It was the Lord's victory. But nonetheless, Gideon was going to, as it were, take the honor and the praise. Gideon, by nature, when we read of him in the chapters in the book of Judges dealing with him, we find that he was the least esteemed in his father's house. He seems to be a timid kind of an individual. And yet on this occasion, he wrought a great victory for Israel. And it was because of faith that he obeyed in reducing his army, almost, we might say, to a handful. 300 men, 300 separate companies of 100 men each, and he won a great victory. That's the kind of thing that the writer has in mind. So he mentions Gideon, and then he mentions Barak. And Barak's an interesting character because he, you remember, went out with Deborah, the prophetess, to win a great victory over the Ammonites, was it, or the Canaanites. And at first Barak refused to go, you remember. And he had to be chided, and he had to be almost, as it were, cajoled to go with Deborah and the army against the enemies of the Lord. But he finally went, and Deborah and Barak together won a great victory. And the writer probably has in mind, as the commentators point out, that Barak probably was reluctant to go because he didn't want to be one of the esteemed victorious ones in Israel. He would rather have Deborah, who was the leading lady at the time, and that she would be the one who would have all the honor. But she commanded him to come, and so he shared in the victory, because he wanted, as it were, Deborah, not himself, to have all the glory. That may well be a reason. We don't know for sure, but what we do know is that what he did in finally going out with Deborah was an act of faith. And then, of course, we have Samson. Well, Samson's well known, his exploits, and all his vices are well known, as well as his virtues. And Samson did many things by faith, and the greatest thing he did was in his death. You remember when he brought down the temple of the Philistines and how he destroyed more in his death than in his life. Samson Jephthah is famous for that rather foolish vow that he made. But nonetheless, he was a man of faith. He kept the vow. He should never have made that vow to sacrifice his daughter, but he did make it. He made it with the best of intentions, even though he was wrong. And as far as we know, he kept the faith. And he kept the vow, which again, he perhaps shouldn't have done, but nonetheless, he did it. He is famous for the vow. And then, of course, David is given a mention. There are two books and more of the Old Testament devoted to the life of David. And yet he is only given a mention here. His great exploits against the Philistines and against Goliath, they're not mentioned. David is hardly mentioned at all. We are given, Rahab the harlot is given more space in this great narrative in Hebrews chapter 11 than King David. Because King David's virtues were great, but so were his vices great. And David ended his life as a rather sad and as a rather disappointing old man at the age of 70. He was worn out with war and women, we might say. That was how David ended his life. But nonetheless, he was a man of faith, a man after God's own heart, the sweet psalmist of Israel. And then we're told of Samson, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel. And Samuel was ministering, you remember, in Shiloh, and in the time of Eli and his sons, when they were the priests, when things were bad in Israel. And the word of the Lord came to Samuel when he was only a little boy, and he became the prophet of the Lord and restored the spiritual strength of Israel in his dark and gloomy day. That's what Samuel did. And Samuel is linked to the prophets. We can think of all the prophets, from the earlier prophets, from Hosea and Joel, right down to the later prophets, to Zephaniah and Zechariah and Malachi. And all of them, they spoke the word of the Lord. And what they said came to pass, and how they gathered again the strength and recovered the faith of God's people, because they believed and because they were God's chosen spokesman for the age. So that's the kinds of things that the writer has in mind when he mentions these individuals. Who were they? Well, we're told of some of them, but we're not told all of them. But we are told something common to all of them, because the underlying principle in which they all lived their lives was the principle of faith. Every single one of these people, despite the differences of their circumstances and temperate. Some were bold by nature. Samson seems to be a man full of zip and full of the zest of life. Whereas, as we say, Jephthah seems to be a more retiring kind of individual. And Barak seemed to need a push to take command of the army and to go out with Deborah and that kind of thing. And whatever their circumstances or their temperament, they were all united together with a common belief. They all believed in God. They all acted for God. They all did something that in God's eyes was a demonstration. Here is a man, or here is a woman of faith. And the principle is always the same. Faith in the Scripture is never something secret. It's never something silent. It's never something intensely individual and personalized. It is always, faith in the Scripture is always something in which it can be said we wear our life on our sleeve. We are seen to be men or women by faith. Not only by the things that we do and say, but by the things that we do not do and do not say. Now, there is no such thing as perfect faith among sinners, but there is such a thing as saving faith and genuine faith. And every single one of these individuals who is mentioned, it would be easy for us to highlight some sin in their life. Without exception, even Samuel, he did not rebuke his own sons. Samuel was a good man, but in many ways Samuel also was a failure. Every single one of these individuals had a place and a point in their life that was easily criticized. But the writer is not at pains to criticize the faults of God's people or to emphasize their vices. They had vices aplenty. He is at pains to emphasize the virtues of God's people. And I think we need to take this lesson on board. Because very often we talk more about people's faults and failings than we do about their virtues. How often is it that Christian people almost automatically and instinctively point out, have you heard about so-and-so? He does this, she does that. But where from the same people do you hear words of commendation? Words that are complimentary and encouraging. Recognizing that these people whom they are speaking about are facing temptations and difficulties, and in many ways they are resisting and overcoming them. Where do we find that kind of emphasis made? Very often among Christian people. But yet in the scriptures we find, it is not the vices of David or Samson. They are listed, but that's not the point. These are aberrations to be sure, but nonetheless they are not the tenor of their lives. David was a better saint than he was a sinner, great a sinner though he was. Samson was a better saint than he was a sinner, a great sinner though he was. And the same with all of the ones who are mentioned. If you are simply going to speak about Samuel as a failed father, then woe betide our thinking, Samuel did more good than damage in Israel. And all of these individuals, they are characterized by that great emphasis. And that's why they are mentioned as they are mentioned. And all the prophets, they had their weaknesses. There was a time, you remember, when Ezekiel wanted to give up the ministry I will make, or Jeremiah rather. He wanted to give up the ministry. I will no longer make mention of his name. He was going to stop preaching because he was so discouraged and disheartened by the response of a opposition and rejection to his ministry by the people of Judah. And yet the fire of the Lord's word was burning in his bones, and he could not keep it in, and he had to speak. So his faith overcame his feelings. And we can think of Isaiah the prophet also. He was facing a desolating ministry. Go to this people and speak to them, but they're not going to listen to you. Go and you're going to spend 40 years preaching to the people of Israel. And by and large, at the end of it all, Isaiah would say, who is believing our report? There's hardly a soul believing what I'm saying. But still he said it, and he said it again and again and again. And he was finally martyred, we believe, for the faith that he had in the God of Israel, sawn in sunder. And so all of these individuals, all of them, we're told, are characterized by faith. And there are many others whom the writer could mention also. They all have faith. They all believe. They all love God. They all love righteousness. They all hate sin. They are all brothers in arms, as it were, in the one faith of the gospel. That's the first thing that we can emphasize about these individuals. Who were they? But then we're told also, or we could ask the question, well, what did they do then? What is so significant about them? Who through faith? These are the individuals that he's speaking about. And he tells us what they did. He says, through faith, he says, they subdued kingdoms. They wrought righteousness. They obtained promises. They stopped the mouths of lions. They quenched the violence of fire. Escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weakness, they were made strong. They waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. What are we told about them? We are told that these people who through faith subdued kingdoms and wrought righteousness and obtained the promises. Now, immediately we can think of the victories of Jephthah and Barak, and of course King David particularly, conquering the nations round about him, winning the victories, securing the land for the possession of the Lord's people. But also they wrought righteousness. It wasn't simply that they were killing people and expelling the Canaanites. They were establishing the proper religion in Israel. They were securing protection for the law of God and for the people of God. They were doing something for God's people in the exploits that are recorded of them. And we think of Samuel, when the priesthood had almost just about gone to pot in his day under Eli and his wicked sons.
and how the word of the Lord came to young Samuel. Until he was an old man, he preached the word of the Lord. And the word of the Lord, which had been rare or scarce in Israel in previous generations, was now a living, vital force again. And we find that the prophet Samuel was ministering basically in a place called Shiloh, which later on was destroyed by the Canaanites. But it was from there that he went on his annual tour. He went round all the, as it were, all the territories of Israel, we're told. He went on an annual journey, preaching the word of the Lord. The people would come to Samuel at Shiloh, but Samuel would go to the people to speak to the tribes in their various tribal territories. And in doing so, he was establishing righteousness, telling them the ways of the Lord. This is the way, walk ye in it. That's what these men were doing. And King David, too, in writing the Psalms that we still sing to this very day, and these great Psalms like the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd," which is sung on so many happy as well as so many sad funeral occasions, because it is so full of gospel truth. You can hardly sing the Psalms of David without having some impetus of righteousness embedded into our very souls. And so what these men were doing was something good. And even Samson himself, despite all his sensuous bloodthirstiness, was a man who asked God in the end to give him strength to slay the enemies of Israel. And he did. He was given that strength. His weakness lay, his strength, as it were, lay not in his muscular power, but in the fact that he was a Nazarite. And as long as he kept the Nazarite vow and the evidence of it in the length of his hair, the Lord would strengthen him for his various exploits. So they were enabled to do great things for God because of the faith that they had. Or God was doing great things for them. God was honoring their faith in that he was doing his work and doing it well through them. Who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, the promise of the possession of the land, stopped the mouths of lions. We can think of Daniel in the lion's den. We can think of Samson, you remember, perhaps taking the slaying lion. We can think of David being delivered from the mouth of the lion and the bear, as he reminded Goliath, the giant, when he slew him in the days of his youth. Quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong. And here we are being reminded of what they did. In themselves they were weak. They were weak. David in his Psalms confesses to weakness. He confesses to his flesh being unable, his wounds stinking. And yet his hope was in the Lord. Enemies plotting against him, terrified and downcast. Yet I give myself into the hands of the Lord. And over again we find this principle. Out of weakness they were made strong. They waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. And we can think again of Barak and Deborah, and we can think of Jephthah and David, and so on and so on. So these people, they were enabled to do things. Now, faith is always like that. There are battles to be won. There are temptations to be overcome in the life of faith. The life of faith has never been, as it were, a smooth, easy road where we just drift along, slide along pleasantly into the promised land and glory, here I come after the happy, happy days all my life. Faith is not like that. These people had to struggle because they were up against the aliens. They were up against their own flesh. They were up against their own families even. You remember how Jephthah, for example, was held in contempt by his half-brothers. We can think of David being held in contempt by his own elder brothers. And we can think even of David's father, not even considering when Samuel, you remember, went to anoint one of the sons of Jesse. And it seemed to occur to the old man to bring in the youngest. Surely he wouldn't be the one who could be the Lord's anointed. It didn't seem to occur to him. And all the elder brothers came in, you remember, before Samuel. Jesse had called them all. And the Lord passed them all by. This is not the one. This is not the one. Have you any more sons? Says Samuel to Jesse. Well, I've got one more. And he's out looking after the sheep. Well, bring him in. He's only a boy. Well, bring him in. And as soon as David came in, there's a description, the first description given in the Old Testament of David, that he was ruddy in appearance. And he came in and he was handsome and he was beautiful. And the Lord said, this is the one. To the surprise and perhaps the shock of the whole of the community, this is the one. Out of weakness, they were made strong. And certainly in his earlier days, David recognized that he belonged to a lowly place. Who am I that I should be called the king's son-in-law? Who am I and who is my family that we should be honored in this particular kind of way? Faith takes, as it were, a good stock of itself, because faith faces reality. Faith recognizes that we are weak. We are not great. The man or the woman who thinks that he is strong and therefore he is going to be a giant in the faith is under a great misleading delusion. Not by works of righteousness that we have done. The moment that you and I think we are great and strong, at that moment we are weak. The Apostle Paul said to the Corinthians, it is when I am weak, then I am strong. It is in my weakness that Christ's strength is always made perfect, in my weakness. And in each of these individuals that we're looking at this morning, it was true of all of them without exception. Samuel, as a little boy, a weak boy who hardly even knew the Lord, was given a task that was beyond his boyish years. He couldn't perform the task of a prophet, but he was called upon to be so because the Lord would be with him. And it was the word of the Lord that was in the mouth of Samuel, we're told. And so they were waxing strong out of the weak, human, fallible, failing human material. God was making of them mighty warriors and great men and great women who were able to do things. And they went out to battle with 300 soldiers only, and they would turn to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. We can think of the widow of Zarephath and Elisha the prophet, or Elijah the prophet, you remember, and how the widow's son was raised back. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. We have here a reference to the resurrection. And there are those who say that the Old Testament has a rather gloomy picture of life after death. Well, not according to the psalmist David, it didn't. The psalmist David reminds us in Psalm 23 that only goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. You remember how we've already seen in previous studies in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they look for a better country. They look for a heavenly city. They knew that Canaan was not the end of the promise. The promised land was not their ultimate destiny. They knew it was a kind of stepping stone, a kind of pattern, a kind of place that typified a better place. And they looked for a better country. They looked for a heavenly country because they looked for the city which has foundations, whose builder and whose maker is God. Right throughout the whole narrative, there is this implication. A better thing awaits God's people, always a better place and a better thing than anything we have ever imagined or ever experienced in this present life. That's what this great chapter is all about. And that is not some New Testament doctrine only. That is the Old Testament doctrine. Psalm 16. Thou wilt not leave my soul in the grave. At thy right hand there are pleasure forevermore. I shall not die but live, says the psalmist in Psalm 118. I shall not die but live, and I shall see the works of the Lord. You remember Job in Job's book of Job, chapter 19. I know that my Redeemer liveth, and in my flesh I shall stand upon the earth. And I myself, in my own flesh, I shall see God.
What do these texts mean unless they mean the same thing as our writer is saying here, that they might obtain a better resurrection? When Moses was enabled to choose suffering for the people of God or with the people of God rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, accounting the riches of Christ, suffering for Christ, greater riches than all the treasures of Egypt. What on earth was the writer talking about? What was Moses thinking about when he thinks of the greater treasure, suffering for Christ, and better than all the treasures of Egypt? Is there nothing better in Egypt than all the treasures of Pharaoh's household? Well, Moses thought so, and it wasn't in any Pharaoh's household it was to be found. It wasn't to be found in this world at all. It was to be found in the Christ. Greater treasures, a great reward, says the scripture, is to be found by those who seek after God. And we could multiply example after example after example. And that's what motivated, that's why they did these things. When Barak and Jephthah went out to battle, and even sometimes David perhaps would go out, and there perhaps would be a measure of fear within their hearts. Can we win this battle? Can we overcome these enemies with 300 soldiers? Can we win a warfare where a woman is the general in command of the army? Can we possibly prevail? But they went out. They went out, not knowing for certainty, but confident that whatever the outcome would be, it would be God's will and God's way that was done. And so acting in faith doesn't foresee always the immediate victory or the blessing, but it faces the issue and it does what needs to be done. And that's what faith is all about. There are issues in your life and mine where we might say common sense would tell us to hold back. And the Word of God says, no, you don't hold back, you go forward. And we leave the issue with God. That's what this is all about. And that's why they were enabled to do the exploits that these individuals mentioned were enabled to do, and all the prophets along with them. They were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. We can think, for example, of, you remember Daniel, the three children, Daniel's three companions in Daniel chapter 3, the fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar, that great terrifying furnace, seven times hotter than it should have been. And unless you bow down before my golden image, that's into that fire you will go. And you remember Daniel and the children, their response. It may well be that you can put us into the fire if you like. It may be that our God will deliver us. It may be he will not deliver us. It doesn't matter. We will not bow down to your golden image. And it doesn't matter if we are burnt to a cinder. And if our atoms disappear in the smoke, it doesn't matter to us. We will not bow down before your golden image. We will not accept this idolatry as a way of deliverance. Not accepting deliverance, we are told, that they might obtain a better resurrection. So first of all, who are these people? Well, that's who they are. In many ways, weak, ordinary failures, sins in their flesh rising up to torment them, to lead them astray. Weak in faith at times, and yet their faith was always the same, looking unto Jehovah, the God of their fathers. And there were those moments when they were enabled to do extraordinary things. And it's these extraordinary moments that are the reality of the genuine faith in their hearts. Things that seem to be strange, unusual, perhaps in the eyes of many uncertain things, ventures that seem too dangerous to enter into. But they did it because they believed, who through faith subdued kingdoms and so on. Well, having looked at who they are and what they did, there's a final issue this morning. And it's this, what do these things teach us? Well, they teach us something about God as well as something about ourselves. And they teach us that God uses the weak and the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, as Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians. He doesn't choose the wise. He didn't choose the wisest of men or the wisest of women. He didn't choose Jephthah because he was the greatest in his father's household. Jephthah was contemptible in the eyes of his brothers. And he was the least in his father's household. He confesses that. David was the least in his household. And Samuel was only a boy. I am not worthy. I am not fit, he could say along with Jeremiah. But God does choose unexpected individuals. Sometimes we have high hopes, don't we? We look at some people who are brought up in the church or who have great virtues or great natural gifts, we might say. And we think, now there's a man or there's a woman, there's a boy from his boyhood. He is destined for great things. And they reach their 21st birthday and then they reach 30, then they reach 40 and then they go on. And they turn out to be not so great after all. They turn out sometimes to be a disappointment. And the great ambitions or the great signs of greatness that we once thought they possessed, they weren't really signs of greatness. They were simply in our own imagination or our fond dreamings. And sometimes someone might come out of the blue with no background, with very little education, who is converted perhaps later on in their life, and they come out and they begin to mature and they begin to grow and they begin to be seen to be stalwarts for God. And they begin to do things for God. They begin to show a consistency. They begin to show a willingness, dare I put it like this, to take chances on faith. They are enterprising. They are, as it were, entrepreneurs in the life and in the adventure of faithful living. And they begin to step out and begin to do things that need to be done and say things that need to be said. God chooses the weak things of the world. But also it tells us something else about God. It tells us that God doesn't expect the same from everybody. Not only does he not choose exactly the same, but he doesn't expect the same. He doesn't expect, for example, Barak to do what King David would do. Neither does he expect King David to do what Jephthah was able, or what Gideon was able to do with 300 soldiers. There's no record of David anywhere going out to warfare on a major battlefield with only 300 soldiers. He would gather his armies together. Yes, in the cave of Adullamid, 1,000 soldiers, we know. Men like himself who were refugees from Saul's wrath and malice. But nonetheless, when he became the king, he would use mighty armies to win his mighty victories. No mention there of 300 will do. David would take as many with him as he possibly could to ensure the victory. And all of them were asked to do different things. Samuel was asked not to go to war, but to speak the word and to go to the people. And all of them, they did different things. God doesn't expect you and I to do what the Puritans were doing because we're living in different times. He doesn't expect us to do what the reformers were to do because we're not living in reforming times. The people were with the reformers. The people were with the Covenanters and the Puritans. They were the popular party. They were never short of a congregation, we might say. Sometimes larger, sometimes smaller gatherings, but they were never short of a hearing. And the same with the Wesleys and Whitfield. When they were to go out, there was a congregation waiting, sometimes maybe as many as 30,000, waiting to hear them. They were going to preach where the people were. It's not like that today. I have no guarantee that if I went out into that park over there, that I would have a gathering of people. I'm not commanded to do that because that's not the time. That's not the ministry in the times in which we live. We have to understand that times do change, and times change for every single one of them. But in each of the circumstances, God had his man or his woman for the times and the circumstances. You and I are to serve God where we are, in the time and in the place of God's appointment. But one thing that we do know is this, that God does require faithfulness by faith. And faith in Old Testament terms, in the vast overwhelming instances in which it occurs, means faithfulness. It possibly is only in Habakkuk chapter 2 at verse 4 that faith in the Old Testament means specifically faith in the sense that we understand it mainly from the New Testament. In the Old Testament, faith is the life that we live, the evidences of faith. The New Testament is more analytical, more systematic, and it is more cerebral in its analysis and in its breaking down of what faith is. But in the Old Testament, it is what faith does that matters. Because some of the faith in these people probably would hardly pass muster for membership in this congregation, for example. That may well be the case. David certainly would not be an elder, because he lacked the moral qualities required of such an office in the New Testament church, for example. And so it teaches us something about God. These individuals also teach us something about individuals, God's people. And it is this, that when God calls us to do something in faith, he is calling us to do something that is possible. We were reading in Hebrews chapter 12 this morning as our reading. And we are told in that chapter of how we are to run with endurance the race that is set before us. Immediately that we are introduced to the practical part of this epistle, we are immediately reminded that there are difficulties to overcome, obstacles to contend with, temptations to face, choices to be made. And they're not easy choices, but they are possible choices. The obstacles are not insuperable. The temptations are not insurmountable. And the lifestyle that is set before us is a reasonable and a possible lifestyle for us to live. Let us run with endurance, laying aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. Let us pursue holiness, that great virtue of the Christian life where we are set apart from secular things in order to devote ourselves to sacred things. That's what sanctification, holiness is. Such a life is neither unreasonable nor impossible. And the reason I'm emphasizing that is because sometimes we make excuses for ourselves. And our low spirituality and our low level of Christian living is because life is too hard, or life is too complicated, or I was tempted. And the Bible gives no value or support to any of these arguments. Because for every time of need there is grace supplied. For every vice there is an alternative of virtue. The Christian life is a reasonable life because it is possible. God does not ask us to do the impossible. And in our hyper-Calvinistic tendencies, there's the danger that we may imagine that God is tempting us and indeed mocking us. Be holy, but you can't be holy. That's not biblical teaching. We can be holy if we set our minds to it, because God can make us willing in a day of his own power. And the fact that we are not holy is because very often we choose not to be holy, because the pleasures of sin take precedence over the pleasures of righteousness. These people, they tell us a great deal about God. They tell us a great deal about human nature. And all of these people, they had alternatives. Jephthah didn't need to go out to battle. Samson didn't need to slay the Philistines. He could have indulged himself in the flesh pots of the Canaanites. And the others, Gideon, and so on and so on. David could have always indulged himself with his pleasures of the rooftops. But there was another way to live, and they chose the other way. And in so choosing it, they honored God. And that is why they're mentioned in the annals of the godly and the good, the faithful and the fruitful. And as Paul tells us, he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It wasn't that these individuals were strong and great and wise and mighty soldiers by nature. It was God who made them great. But they were also willing to be made great God's way. And that was what so attracted the writer's attention to them and makes them worthies for us to consider, to think about them, to be challenged by them, and to follow in their footsteps. By faith, they overcame. And they are not the only ones, as he says. There are many more, but I don't have time to tell you about them. But I've said enough, because what has been said is good enough to challenge and to change us and to encourage us. That's the point of it all. May God bless his word to us.